essentially, it was an opportunity to model Colossians 3 to, with my secular work, to work as unto the Lord, to kind of model the challenges to be both missional in the workplace, to be committed to discipleship, and really, I think that was helpful for our church plan.
Hello, welcome to Independence, the FIEC podcast. My name is Adrian Reynolds. I'm the head of national ministries for the FIEC, and I'm joined today by Rob Scuthern. Hello, Rob.
Hi, Adrian.
Welcome. Welcome. You've travelled across, well, you've gone via Nottinghamshire, from Derbyshire here to Leicestershire. So welcome to FIEC Towers and to the podcast. It's great to have you with us. Just tell us a little bit about you. So you're from Bakewell. We'll come to that in a moment. But you're married, you've got kids. Just give a quick 30 seconds. Who's Rob?
Yeah, I'm married to Claire. Okay. She's a nurse.
But one wife. That's a good start.
Thank you very much. Yeah, she's the best of us.
Yeah.
She's a nurse, a Peak District nurse. We live in Bakewell. Got three children. I've got Grace, who's 14. I've got Harry, who is 11. I feel like I'm being tested here. And Theo will turn 8 in December.
And some dogs.
I've got two black Labradors. I am your stereotypical rural guy.
You are. You're not wearing cords today, which I'm glad to see, but you are. Let's just talk a little bit about Bakewell. So you've just hinted it's in the Peak District, which was the first national park in the UK, I think. Is that right? Come on, get brilliant, some local
brilliant,
knowledge.
Brilliant start. So the Peak District is a fantastic place. I didn't know it was the first national park. I should know that. There are some false stats.
Don't write in if I'm wrong about that. Just, yeah, whatever.
There's some false stats. There's somebody says that there's more people that visit the Peak District than some of these great national parks in the world. So don't believe everything you read on the internet.
Okay.
Yeah. Should I tell you about the Peak District?
Well, that would be a nice start, wouldn't it?
Yeah, there's 38,000 people that live in the national park, and there's this weird boundary of the national park that cuts out a lot of the more urban places. So the national park strictly cuts out Buxton and Matlock and places like that. So there is one market town within the national park boundary, which is Bakewell, which is about 4,000 people.
So we know it from its puddings. Or tarts.
Tarts are our
which
cheap
are nothing,
export.
Nothing like Mr. Kipling. If you want a real Bakewell pudding, you need to go to Bakewell, and it's quite something, I tell you.
Yeah.
But what kind of place is it?
Yeah, I mean it's a beautiful place. I mean, Claire's a farmer's daughter from the area, so we visited before we moved to the area. I visited the place, and I thought this is a kind of place that I would like to live. But below that beautiful veneer, there's a spiritual barrenness. Mm. There's a hardness of heart. And though during the great during evangelical awakenings, the chapels have erupted.
It's a great Wesleyan movement, actually, across the Peak District historically. But now, very little happening. Is that right? Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I mean, I use this metaphor quite a bit, so apologies if you heard this before, but I feel like those chapels that have erupted and been built have been left now like ships with a retreating tide.
Okay.
Many of them are shops. So when Claire was a little girl, there was a Bakewell circuit of chapels, the independent chapels that partnered together. Yeah. There were 20 of them, and now there's only a very few left and really struggling.
Yeah. Yeah.
So a real area of need.
So great gospel need. And I mean, it always strikes me, Bakewell's a very variable place, that you can go on a wet Wednesday afternoon in February, and it kind of feels, you know, like it's the land that time forgot. But you come in July on a hot summer's day, absolutely heaving with people, because obviously centre of a tourist industry in the Peak District, lots of people going on. So it must be quite a variable place in that sense, is it?
Yeah, I mean, you've described our experience.
Expensive housing because of all the tourists and stuff. And
exactly that. Millions and millions of people every year come through Bakewell. Mm-hmm. It's a ridiculous stat of how many people live within 1 hour. When you think of Manchester to the west, you've got Sheffield to the north, Chesterfield to the east, Nottingham to the south.
Me, almost. Not quite, but almost. An hour to Matlock for us, so not much further to Bakewell.
Yeah, not at all. So yeah, on a bank holiday Monday, you've got the agricultural market, which is crazy busy in itself, kind of hub for agriculture in Bakewell. And then with all the tourists, it's like a transformed market town on some days, and then others, it's like deserted. It's crazy. Yeah.
Now, we're not, you might think we're here to talk about rural ministry, but we're not. We are going to talk about that another time. So look forward to coming back to that subject. But we're actually here to talk about I should have said this earlier. We're here to talk about bivocational leadership in the church, by which we simply mean you are leading the church alongside doing something else. Now, I realize every leader who's listening to this is pulled in multiple different directions. You know, they have responsibilities at home. They might have responsibilities with parents, for example, or with, you know, we're in a stage where we've got responsibilities with grandchildren. So lots of people are pulled in different directions, but we're basically talking about two paid jobs. So that you're giving your time to the church in a formal capacity. The church has recognized you as a leader, but actually you're also employed somewhere else. That's what we're talking about, isn't it? When we talk about bivocational ministry. So there you were. Bakewell needed a church, right? That's the bottom line. And it's not just Bakewell, it's the surrounding area, as you've identified this kind of sort of, 38,000 people doesn't sound like very many, but spread actually around a large area. So it's quite a disparate place, isn't it? Needed a church. You were doing what at that time? So you'd been in the army. I like to call you the colonel. You never quite rose to those heady heights. But you just told me, as we were meeting just now, Rob, that if you were still in the army today, you'd be a 4-star general. So I feel I need to give you the deference that you didn't say that, but that's what I like to think. So you'd been in the army, a maths teacher as well. So just tell us that story very briefly. How did you come to be thinking about planting a church in Bakewell, of all places?
Yeah, I mean, when I answer that question, I always say I became a Christian. I became a Christian very, very late in life. So okay. I was 28.
Well, that itself is a great encouragement, because I think we sometimes think 28-year-old blokes, especially those who are in the army, too hard. But you became a Christian at 28. Well, that's great news.
Yeah, I had one Christian friend in my battalion when I was serving, called Liam. And the Lord used Liam to lead me to himself.
What great news.
Yeah, people didn't mock Liam. He was 20 stone, 6'8", rugby player. But what a great witness. But I became a Christian, and that changed everything.
Right.
My outlook. I ended up, Claire was a Royal Air Force nurse, and together we were based down south, and we ended up connecting with a really good church, Chessington.
Yeah. What
was Chessington Evangelical?
Yes, King's Church,
Chessington.
Yeah.
And we were really invested in and blessed and really grew in maturity. And one of the things we understood as we were disciple was the need to be a light in the area that we were living in. Grace came along, and we ended up relocating up north.
So had you become a teacher by this point? Or were you still in the army?
Yeah, so sorry, in 2009, before Grace came along, in our first year of marriage, Claire had been to Afghanistan. Before she'd come back, I was being deployed again. And it was one of those that we thought, is this going to be our life? And we made a decision. Really, because I knew that Claire had the blessing of an early conversion, that I needed to grow in maturity. Yeah, and to do that, I really needed to be part of a local church for a while. So we decided to leave in 2009. So we were down in Chessington. I got a teaching job. So I transitioned out of the army. I played Army Navy rugby on the Saturday, started teaching on the Tuesday.
And teaching maths. Teaching maths. Like all this, I might have thought you would be teaching PE or something, but no, teaching maths.
I want to say it was maths because that sounds much more impressive, but it was about 50-50 timetable. There was a lot of sport in it.
I know you love your sport.
And I ended up teaching in a school in Bakewell.
Right, okay.
So we relocated.
So it's all part of the Lord's providence, really, bringing you to this place and seeing the need and seeing the need for a church to be planted. Yeah. When did you start sensing the Lord laying that on your heart, that there's a need for a church here?
Yeah, well, I was chatting to our old pastor, Trevor Archer, who's been a big influence in my life. And one of the things I was looking to do as a school teacher and with the leadership responsibilities was really develop my ability to handle God's word.
Yeah.
And he signposted me to some theological training, mm-hmm. Which is now Crosslands.
Yep.
And I was basically doing as many of these foundation modules.
You were hungry for it.
Oh, I was. I was that guy. Yeah. And I read something and it really challenged me, Adrian. It was it was something from C.S. Lewis, and I'm just going to probably really hash this up and mess it up. But it was something like the conversations that we're having with people aren't with mere mortals, Lewis says, but with either everlasting splendors or immortal horrors that you wouldn't want to see in your worst nightmare. Yeah. And the challenge from C.S. Lewis was the conversations we're having with people are leading people to one of two destinations. And Claire and I were convicted by this study that we were living in this place, but we were traveling out to church, 30 minutes towards Chesterfield, a great church, Homegate, another FYC church. Where we were blessed, but we weren't investing in these people. And there were six youth. I was having a conversation with Claire. There were six youth on our wall. And we were just really, it can sound ultra spiritual, but we were convicted by their eternal destinations. And we'd been.
I think that's what the Lord does. He lays things on our hearts. I think sometimes it's you know, the providence of God is that sometimes you find yourself in a place, you just have an overwhelming sense, don't you? I think that's how God works.
Yeah. So we hadn't heard of church planting. And what essentially happened is we'd been youth leaders at Chessington, and we just started a youth group up for the village for these six youth that were sat on our pestering us on our wall, and there was fruit from there. One of the mums started to read the Bible. She's now a baptized member of our church.
Wonderful. Great.
And it was the elders at Homegate that started to challenge us that actually this looked like something was happening. And I was then invited to do a church planting residency with a church in Sheffield. Yeah. And then was supported by the FIC to then see a church planted.
So here you are. And when we're going to record another episode with you about rural church, and we'll ask you a bit more about Peak Trinity. But it's been a bit of a roller coaster in some ways, but it's extraordinary ride, and I've enjoyed hearing about it. We're not going to do that now, so don't. You're about to launch because you're excited about the church. I can see that, but just hold back. We're talking about bivocational ministry.
Yeah.
You started as a bivocational pastor, right? What did that look like? A, B. Why did you do it that way?
Yeah. It looked like you described bivocational as having more than one paid role. So I was teaching 4 days a week when we planted, and the rest of the time, which was about 4 days, was for the church. Anybody that's a primary school teacher would just know just how all encompassing that was. I was experienced with secondary age. Teaching mathematics, but the part-time job that I could get was this. So it was pretty intense, and that one day was just kind of swallowed up by lots of things. But we felt that it was necessary. It was one of the reasons why we were planting. There was an operational budget for the church plants, and 90% of that operational budget was coming externally.
Right. Okay.
So we felt for this church plan to be sustainable with this operational budget, because we also wanted to be invested in other things outward looking. We believe that this was a model that would be sustainable.
Yeah.
So
it wasn't just pragmatic though, was it? It was the principle behind it. You saw, didn't you, the need to be connected into the community and have roots in the community and that kind of thing.
Oh, there's definite benefits from it.
Tell us what some of those are, Rob.
Yeah, great question. I think genuinely one of the main benefits for us being bivocational was as a leader of a plant where you're calling essentially leadership is modeling. Yeah. Modeling the Christian life, modeling what it looks like to follow Jesus. Essentially, it was an opportunity to model Colossians 3 to, with my secular work, to work as unto the Lord, to kind of model the challenges to be both missional in the workplace, to be committed to discipleship, and really, I think that was helpful for our church plant to have somebody who wasn't just it's never, you know, pastors aren't, it's not just rhetoric with pastors, but actually they could see that I was living it as well, and I think that was helpful in our community for people to see. To see me having more than one.
Do people find that in the community find that odd? You know, I think people who have got no church background, I'm thinking you have this vision of a church minister, either being a slacker, he works one day a week, or he walks around in a dog collar, blessing the pets. Is that an odd thing? You know, I'm a pastor of a church, I'm leader of a church, but I also work part time as a teacher. Did people kind of find that weird?
Well, I think they genuinely think I'm weird anyway, Adrian. So it's just
fair point. Yeah.
And being a Christian, you're already in that category. But I think particularly in the rural context that we are, people know you. You're with them. They see you. I'm not sure if it added a huge amount of credibility to my outreach, but it certainly didn't make me any weirder than I already was.
And you're plugged into the community in other ways, I know, because you help out with the rugby team and stuff like that. So there's lots of ways that you're rooted in. So here was a decision that was partly born out of necessity. You know, you had a limited amount of cash and you didn't want to spend it all on you. I mean, there are other things that needed to be funded, but also out of principle. Is there an element of pragmatism as well? You know, as the church grew, presumably could have taken you on full time, and we'll come to how that happened in just a moment. But is pragmatism as well involved in this, isn't there, in terms of what the church does with its money?
It really was pragmatic as well, if that's the right word. We had limited financial resources, and we really wanted to invest in. Missions overseas. So we wanted to be a church that wasn't just for the villages,
wanted to be
a church for the ends of the earth. From day one, we wanted to support those missionaries that we did in Nigeria and Tanzania in Paris and onwards. But also they came an opportunity to take somebody else on. So David, who is a co-leader with me, we make up the eldership. There was an opportunity to bring David on 2 days a week it's not that I can't do administration, but in this executive administrative role, which was just really, in those early days of becoming a CIO and all those kind of things, was just really helpful, a complementary set of gifts. And rather than me be full-time, there was an opportunity for David to come on board 2 days a week. Mm. And I think the church were blessed by that.
Yeah. I think what you're describing is very interesting to me, because I think, you know, very often we want to be principled and we can see the benefits of a particular course of action. Sometimes we're driven by necessity. We also want to be, maybe pragmatic isn't the right word, we want to be kind of rounded and thoughtful in terms of how we're planning. You want to be generous church from day one and have that as part of the kind of the DNA of the church. And all of those things are going on at the same time. Mm. It's quite complicated, isn't it? You know, actually, how do you make decisions as a church where you've got almost what are competing? You know, you want to give time to the church, but you also want to be rooted into the community. You want to, you know, use your money well, but you also want to be, you know, and do things for the church and for the mission of the church, but you also want to be generous. I think you're juggling lots of different competing stuff, aren't you? It's a complicated question as to how you make a church plant work, basically. That's what you're wrestling with, isn't it?
Really is. And one of the things that we were considering with this as well was because we were a rural plant, we were planting with very few people, so we were reliant on that external funding. We really recognise, I know we're not talking about rural too much, but this rural need, not just in Great Britain, but around the world, to see churches revitalised and churches planted in that area. Streams of funding were going to be a key component to that. And actually, you may be able to raise funds for somebody to be bivocational and yet not full time. And so by us adopting this model, and you know, we were praying, God willing, this would be fruitful, it might just catalyze more rural planting with small teams like ours. Yeah. And we thought that was important.
Because that's how it's going to happen, right? Mm. So if you're in a city, and you're overflowing as a church, and you look at the next borough. I mean, I spend a long time in East London. You look at the next borough, you see there's no church in East London, in the next borough along, and you're a church of 200. You know, planting 50 people is you know, it's costly. Of course it's costly, but it's probably not, you know, it's not catastrophically costly, and you can almost plant a fully formed church that's got a, you know, someone to do this, someone to do that, someone to do the other. You're talking about a situation where you're really starting small, because that's all you can do. And so you have to flex your methods, don't you, to fit into that model. So actually, that's really encouraging hearing that, Rob, because it means that lots more church plants can happen. You know, great need in the Peak District, right? For churches, great need all around the country for churches, as you rightly just told me, great need around the world. How's that going to happen? Well, it's going to happen basically by small churches being started, isn't it?
Yes.
That's the story of Peak Trinity.
I think so. That is our story. Yeah. But I'd also say, you know, people might be thinking, oh, we can't afford to have somebody come in and lead our chapel or our church in this next stage of life or whatever, because we know that they're convicted they need to be generous with the salary, recognizing the what the worker is doing, biblical principle. But we can't provide that salary full time. But what if they could afford a generous salary for half a week or 2 days a week? And that was up front in the recruitment process. What if that was up front in terms of the cultivating church planters and revitalizers into these works? What if that was the model? And actually, we're up front, we're recruiting bivocational people that may be able to supplement that ministry way.
So we are limited by our all or nothing approach, aren't we?
Maybe.
I think we are. You know, come on, say it. We are limited by all. I'm just thinking of a church I know, an FIC church, reasonably large church, where one of the elders is bivocational, works 4 days a week in the secular world, and then gives a day and a half to working in the church, something like that. And that's really blessed the church. It's not just we're not just talking about the senior pastor here. You know, across the church, that sort of bivocational model, which of course is ironically very developed in some areas. Lots of churches would have a part-time women's worker, perhaps, but we don't often think about it for the pastor, the planter. Yes. But I hear what you're saying. You're telling me we should be thinking about that. And actually, that just opens up all different kinds of avenues, doesn't it, for us as church planting?
Yeah. I think so. But it's hard, Adrian.
Well, tell us what's hard about it.
I shouldn't have said that, because knowing that I get a question back, should I?
No,
It is hard. I think it's hard.
Everybody's different, right? Mm. We're all wired differently, and every church situation is different. And having already just defined bivocational, I'm now going to get calls from people saying, well, that's not quite bivocational. So there are different models of that.
Yeah.
But tell us your story. What was hard about it for you, Rob?
I think it's just as you asked that question, the thing that comes to mind was just the sense of being a time thief constantly.
What do you mean by that?
I was robbing time from my family, for my ministry, robbing time from my family for my school job, robbing time sometimes where I perhaps should have been prioritizing preparing lessons for the next day for a ministry task It just constantly found this sense that I wasn't stealing,
but the juggling of the balls,
this sense of discontent that I wasn't quite invested in any of these in the way that I really wanted to be, and that was, you know, that hurt. It felt like the family were often coming second, third, in this bivocational model. And praise God, I don't think there's been any damage there. But there were times in the early days of being bivocational, because the 4 day, 1 day thing shifted over time. The way we justified it, or I justified it to Claire, was this is a season.
Yeah.
Okay. And it's until the church grows, you know, it's going to be like this, but it's not always going to be like this. And actually, I probably should have had somebody just kind of auditing what I was doing with my time, helping me be accountable with my time on that, because
as Christians, we want to do the things we do well.
Mm.
You know, some Christians are slackers, but most Christians are hardworking and diligent and have a you know, deep sense of commitment to the things they take on, whether that's family or church or, you know, another paid occupation. And so we end up, lots of Christians overwork for that reason. Mm. And we end up just wanting to do all the things we do well. So I think the danger is, certainly as I observe from the outside, you end up doing basically two full-time jobs if you're not careful, because you want to do things as well as you can do them.
That's right.
Yeah.
And you think you've got to perform better than you are doing.
Or better than you have the time to do.
Yeah. So preaching being a prime example of
So you can't spend 20 hours on a sermon.
Right.
Vocational, right?
Right. No, right.
Some of the people we preach to, you and I, Rob, they might wish we spent a bit longer on our sermons, but you just can't.
You can't.
And you have to live with that.
Yeah. There are a number of times in the early days, our church have been so gracious to me over the years. I remember our first series, it was Colossians.
Okay.
Teaching 4 days a week, one day for church. That day got swallowed up this particular week, as it so often did. And I was prepared to go in on Sunday with this half-baked effort, just trusting that church would be kind, but there would be enough.
You could only
there
get so far with your sermon. You just didn't have the time. Physically, there was not enough time left in the week.
That's right. So okay. I was ready, and I settled my heart that I didn't have to perform.
Yep.
And then I saw a tweet from somebody saying, looking forward to visiting the new church plant in Bakewell. And it was...
We need to name him. He was a professor of New Testament, wasn't he?
It was David Shaw
David
was
Shaw,
visiting
yes.
In those early days, head of New Testament theology. And I turned to Claire and said, I feel like this is this need to perform and not just enjoy grace as a bivocational minister. I said to Claire, I really need to work even more on my sermon, just because I had this real sense, it wasn't just David, but just this real sense that I needed to perform.
Yeah. So you can't survive as a perfectionist in bivocational ministry. Is that fair?
You can. No. and somebody once said, quite simply, preaching is taking God's word, the sword of the Spirit, plunging it into your own heart, praying that God would do his work, reveal himself to you, that we would behold the glory of Christ, that we would be led to repentance and faith, and then just to share that with brothers and sisters on a Sunday. And quite simply, that's preaching, and that's what I was convicted probably later than I wish I had been about my preaching as a bivocational minister.
So you have to, I mean, the old saying goes, you cut your coat according to the cloth, and you have to do that, don't you?
Yeah.
And actually, that's no bad thing, because I think more so in bivocational ministry, you're constantly thinking about how much time can I give to A, how much time can I give to B, how much time is left for C. You're having to make those judgments. In a way that you obviously do in full-time paid ministry, but actually you have more luxury to do things around the edges, to spend another hour on the sermon, to spend another hour making something look more pretty than it did before, whatever that is, whether that's a sermon or a handout, whatever it is. You've basically got to accept a different sort of level, haven't you?
That's I think you've got to enjoy it. Accept your limitations.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Otherwise, it sucks the joy out of ministry. And there
so that's interesting. Did you find that there were times when it did just that?
Early days, when you fall into that trap that you feel like you've got to perform, you've got to demonstrate that you're displaying some of those metrics, those measurables to people, rather than I was meeting somebody for a coffee and praying or reading a book.
Yeah.
When you fall into that trap that you've got to perform, you don't accept your limitations. Yeah, there were times, and particularly in the early days, where joy was being sucked out of ministry.
Let's not end on a downbeat note.
Yeah.
Please. So you're no longer bivocational. That's a slightly different story.
Now you've outed me at the end of this conversation.
It's a slightly different story, and I don't want to necessarily go into it now. The church has grown and the situation has changed. Let me ask it this way as a way of expressing some of the positives of bivocational ministry. What do you miss about bivocational ministry? Tell us what some of the good things were about it that now it's just harder to grasp hold of.
Yeah, I really enjoyed having those relationships with people outside of the church.
Yeah.
And I still have that. I still have that now. And I, you know, there's lots of things I'm involved in where I'm rubbing shoulders with unbelievers. But back in those bivocational days as a teacher, just being at the sharp end with these people, struggling through work with them, there's just wonderful opportunities and good relationships. And I miss that. I miss teaching. I really enjoyed my other job. Okay. And there are times where I think, oh, you know, I know it was the right decision, but I really miss being in front of a class of teenagers teaching maths and having, you know, and having fun in the classroom. I miss those days.
If you're listening to this and you're thinking, I'd love to hear a bit more about bivocational ministry, do get in touch with us, because there are people in the FIC we can put you in touch with who are pursuing that as a deliberate and intentional way of planting a church, leading a church, and being very thoughtful about it. We'd love to put you in touch with some of them. But it sounds like as well, one of the stories that's coming out here is you can plant. You can plant small, and and the small seeds do grow, and it doesn't need to be fully formed from day one, right? It can be much smaller. You don't simply need to have a little mini-me church that you're planting somewhere else. You can start small, and sometimes the Lord will bless that. Sometimes it doesn't come to anything, but the Lord does bless it. Yeah. And that can be, bivocational can be an important part of that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's our experience.
Yeah.
The Lord can use something small that starts very small and bless others. And we saw people, even though we were a very small church, come to faith. Be baptized. So if anybody's thinking, oh, you know, we need to have all these resources in place, you know, people can plant churches with full-time leadership teams and lots of people and are wonderful. But we can also plant churches with bivocational ministers and small mutually supportive teams.
Yeah.
But I think a big part of that is fellowships like the FIC that can bring together those smaller groups, bivocational ministers and their wives who are counting the cost too,
bring
us together in this mutually supportive kind of context, you know, the conferences, things like that, to kind of talk about these things and encourage one another.
Yeah. Thanks, Rob. I mean, the bottom line is, if Britain is going to be reached for Christ, these are the ways it's going to be reached. You know, planting into cities is important, but smaller places need Christ too. And, you know, how are these places, how is Bakewell ever going to be reached with the gospel? So praise God for what you're doing and just for the way that the Lord has blessed the church. That's really good news. Thanks for joining us, Brigadier or Colonel, whatever you would have been if you'd stayed in the army. It's been lovely to chat. And thanks for joining us too. If you are interested in some of the things you've been talking about, do get in touch with us in the office. We'd love to put you in touch with others who can help, or other churches who have had similar stories, and would be very keen to share those with you too. And if you've enjoyed the podcast, do please rate and review it, because it helps other people find us. Thanks for joining us. This has been Independence, that's what we called, that's right, the FIC podcast, and we'll catch up with you again soon.
Thanks, Adrian.